I was with you the night that you won the National Book Award. I was one of the plethora of reporters to interview you and your colleagues up front. That was a very exciting night for you, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah. It still seems like just a short while ago.
It does. It really does. And now this book is on a paperback already, and you're probably working on about 10 different new projects.
Not yet. No, I've got the other two volumes of the three books in a rough draft. But between the time I won the award and now, I've just been doing other things. I mean, I teach and I've written a lot of book reviews and articles, things like that. So I decided to take a little time off and regroup.
Now you say you have a draft of two other novels. Are you continuing the story of Dick Pierce?
It's not so much Dick as it is the woman that he has an affair with. The next book will probably be Elsie's novel when she's in middle age. So a good deal of time has passed, and some of the characters will be the same, and there'll be some new ones. And then the other volume is a bunch of short stories that have many of the same people. So it's the three books are not bound by plot, but they're bound by place.
Yeah, you know, it's not quite a cliffhanger, but yet you know that the story can go on. I did want to find out what happened to Elsie, because she's going to be living with Mary.
Mary Scanlon, yes.
Mary Scanlon and the baby that she's going to have in Boston, and you wonder how that's all going to fit into her life. So you've left some question marks there that say, hey, let's go on.
Yeah, I'm not sure I did that with a plan in mind. It just the whole thing just grew. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that when I began to write this, I began to write several short stories, and I thought, I'll get a book done, maybe by the end of the year, and then that took about 2.5 years, and I got to the last story, and I thought, this is a very big story. It's not just going to be a short story. And that grew into a whole book. And then I thought, what I really need to do is just write a little piece to finish it off, to answer some of these things in my mind. And that took off. So the whole thing took about 9 years to write. And then I spent another year on Spartina to really fix it and, you know, get it in finished form. And if anyone had said at the beginning of it all, you're going to be change your desk for 9 years, I would have thought this is really hard. But in fact, I never foresaw that, and so I always thought I'd be through by the end of the next year, which is the way to get long things done, is always to think you're about to finish, and you can actually keep a kind of final sprint feeling for a very long time, and I think you almost need that to write well. You need to have the feeling that you're about to burst into something really wonderful. Or that you are in the midst of something wonderful, and it's partly luck that it came out this way, so that I was always leaning forward, in a sense.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about the origins of Spartina, and I know you had a chance to ruminate about it since it's not even on the paperback. But you never actually lived in Morocco, did you?
Oh, yes, indeed, I did. I lived on a very small island, which my first wife and I actually owned. It was very, very small. When the wind blew, in fact, we stayed wet for several days at a time. I mean, it was that small. And we lived there for about 4 years from the time I left Iowa until I... slowly went broke and had to take a teaching job, and then we moved off. And I've been back to Rhode Island since. And in many ways, in fact, I feel most at home there, although I've probably only spent a total of 6 years out of my now fairly long life there.
Must have been a very vivid experience.
Well, it was indeed.
Here we have South County on a map. Portion of South County. I would assume that you lived in a seacoast area, very similar. Well, of course, you said you lived on an island.
Yeah.
It had to be a seacoast. It must be very similar to the
layout
of South County.
Yes. I mean, I know that piece of land that's on that map very, very well. And what I did was to insert a little piece of made-up land And you can't really tell where the real begins and the unreal ends. So I'm not sure why I did that. People have asked me about that, about why I had to invent new ponds and new piece of salt marsh. And part of it was that South County is so small that if I set something in a house, it would actually belong to someone that I might know, and I didn't want to intrude on, you know, on their house. So I decided I'd set this piece of land, which is about 4 miles by 4 miles, and you know, make it completely mine with my people in it.
Well, there's another advantage too. It seems to me it gives you the flexibility of being able to move in a fictionalized way without being held accountable to the facts. After all, you're writing fiction. Yeah.
Although in many ways this is in many ways true to the way people live there. I mean, in that sense it's true. But you're quite right. I'm not tied to the, you know, I'm not tied to every birch tree or pine tree.
Well, that's the point. Somebody's likely to say, John, you got this pond wrong, or you got this little peninsula in and so a fiction writer doesn't really have to be held to that. Degree of credibility, it seems to me, because you have a bigger, higher purpose in trying to develop your characters. But I was shocked about Rhode Island. Toward the end of the book, you have a documentary broadcast that is shown, I think, on Channel 2 in Boston, and everybody's sitting around the Nautilus. No, what's the name of the bar?
The Neptune.
The Neptune. And they're watching this documentary, and Skyler's narrating it, and he has some frightening facts about Rhode Island. I always viewed Rhode Island as a very prosperous, small state, and yet it's stated in this book that anywhere else it would be a third world country. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I can't remember all the things that Schuyler says, but I think that's the true worst case. There is a large gap between the great wealth that exists there and the people who fish or try to farm, and that much is true. There are probably states that are worse off. West Virginia would be one that comes to mind, and that actually may be where I got the line, because the West Virginians that I know often refer to their state as a third world state. So part of it was, part of my feeling came from the time that I spent there, and I worked for a man who farmed. That was my odd job during the 4 years that I lived there. I'd row ashore and help him pull rocks out of a field or do things like that. And I saw just how very hard his life was, and I knew a number of boat builders. The people who tonged clams and put lobster pots out, and their life was very rough. And these were not people who didn't want to work. They worked very hard, and they knew a lot, and their life just got tougher and tougher and tougher. So now the thing that's annoying about Schuyler is that he does this in this kind of breezy, supercilious way, which of course annoys them and stings their pride. But there's some truth in it. Now it may be changing. There is some change, but it's, and they sort of hope in parts of Rhode Island to have something like the Route 128 high tech stuff that's going to come in, and it may happen, and that would be probably for the good. But as it was when I lived there, there was a sort of upper class, and then there was a fairly prosperous middle class, and there was also a very large class that had a very hard time.
Yeah, so much factual information about fishing. You must have gone out on these boats a lot to have all that wealth of information. I never knew all of that. For example, going out for a swordfish, and one swordfish alone can produce $2,000
Well, not quite that much at that time. I mean, I'm not sure what the swordfish prices are now. I do check in from time to time, and I spend time in a small town called Westport Point, Massachusetts, which is very nearby where all of this takes place. All right, and let's say it's selling at $7 a pound, and you get a 200-pound swordfish. Yeah, that's $1,400. So it's close to that. But sometimes you don't get any, and you spend an awful lot of fuel, you know, just going up and down trying to spot one.
So did you also do fishing as well? Did you go on some of these fishing boats? You had to go on some of these fishing boats to have all the tank.
Nope. No. No. I've spent a lot of time in small boats, but I haven't ever been out on a boat like either like the Mamselle or Spartina. I mean, I've been on board, but I haven't gone out for the 9-day haul. And most of that, I knew people when I lived there, really quite well, who would stop by the island, and we'd have a little clam bake or eat fish, and they. At first, didn't talk very much, but as we got to know them and I was there a while, these tales would just unfold. And I didn't really do research, because this was a long time ago, but they stuck in my mind. And it really, it's sort of like a trying to act a part, in a way, that I take pieces of little things that I know how to do or that I've done, and then there's stuff that other people have done, and they can weave into a single strand sometimes if I think about it long enough and ask enough stuff. So this is partly experienced and partly invented. But what I would do is check it out with people who really knew after I had put it down. And almost all the time, that sounds right.
Well, there was the harrowing scene during the hurricane, right? Spartina, way out at sea, hoping to avoid it. You weren't on board a ship or a boat during a hurricane like that, but that was absolutely harrowing. But that's something else you must have checked, because there must have been people who were on board.
Yes, no, I've.
Yes,
I must know. I must know. Oh, 20 people that I talked to who have had, who have been through storms of that size, and I've been in smaller boats in full gales, and was plenty scared. So again, it's that my small experience and 20 other people's large experience, and they got into my brain and sat there for 15 years and slowly. You know, meshed and this came out.
I didn't know until I read the book what the Spartina is. Apparently, it's weeds.
Well, it's a marsh grass. They're not really reedy. I mean, the reeds are fairly thick. Look like cattail stalks. And this is really just a very coarse grass. And of course, I'd lived with it for years and didn't know what it was called. I mean, and actually, an awful lot of people just call it marsh grass. But there's a fair number of people, even just plain folks, who call it Spartina. Although I've also heard it pronounced Spartina, but I don't like the sound of that so well. And I first heard it as Spartina, so I stuck with that. But I had a terrible time trying to figure out what to call this book. I must have had a list of 50 titles. And none of them was any good. So finally we came back to this, and I said, well, why not call it the name of his boat?
And how about what we did?
It's been used. It's been used.
How did it start for you? You initially launched a career as a lawyer, didn't you?
Yeah. When I grew up, my father had been in Congress and practiced law in D.C., and I had uncles who had practiced law, and I went off to school, and I thought that I couldn't become a man until I held some sort of public office, but there was a slight impediment to that, because I couldn't talk in public, as you may notice.
But you can't talk.
Well, it's, now it's going okay, but there were times when I was a kid when I really couldn't talk to other people because I would stutter so badly. Law school was not fun on this account because it's, you know, it's, the teacher's got a large face chart. You know, say, tell me the rule in Hadley versus Baxendale, Mr. Casey. And you turn to just sweat and fear in the back row. And but I got through that. But anyway, I had this notion that I wanted that I did want to do the things that the men I most admired did, and so I kept going that way. Although I did get bounced from after my sophomore year, I got thrown out. Spent 6 months in the Army Reserve, and then worked for a while, and went back and finished. And then I thought, well, you know, I don't really know anything. I'd better go to school some more, which is the way people thought in, you know, 1959 or so. And so I applied to law school and went and hung in there and learned a lot. But around my third year, I started to write stories actually when I was at Fort Knox, and I kept on doing that for the last 2 years of college and the little spare time I had in my 3 years in law school. And my third year in law school, I met Peter Taylor, who finally took me aside and said, "Don't be a lawyer, write." And I thought, all right, I'll give it a try. But I hedged my bet. I went and passed the D.C. bar and worked for a while and then went out to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which I thought I would try for 1 year and see what came up. And once I started doing it, I thought, this is what I really want to do.
Do you see Peter Taylor as a mentor?
Oh, yeah. And then I was in touch with him for a long time after that, and then he was the guy who got me my job at the University of Virginia. And I still see him. He lives down the street.
Wasn't Peter Taylor's book among those nominated for the National Book Award the year that your book
won? No, he won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, 2 years ago. And he's won a whole bunch of other awards too. No, that yes, I'm not sure how I could have taken that if I'd been on the same list as Peter.
No, it was earlier. Yeah. It was the year that Bachman won, I believe, Taylor's.
Yes, book. and Peter withdrew. I'm rather sympathetic to anything he does. But there were people who were ticked off about that. But in one sense he's right, because what he was really saying by what he did was that this isn't a horse race. It's not something that we should let. He said people who write shouldn't be put in this stance of being made to sweat in front of a lot of other folks. I mean, it's you know, it's such a private thing that to turn it into a horse show really goes against the grain. But there are other things to be said about that. But I was sympathetic to him.
Well, he's right in some respects. And a lot of others. One, it's very difficult to judge one book against another. I mean, the books are written so differently. The characters are different. The plot, the writing, the style, and it's really a matter of taste as to what book should win an award. By the same token, I think the book industry needs the publicity. And I think it's also a shot in the arm for the writers.
Oh yeah, no. I have to say I was just thrilled and pleased, and it's done the thing that I want most, which is to get people to read the book. But I would say that the there are two things that have really pleased me about the time that I've spent trying to write fiction, which has been a long time now. One was that all of my books have stayed in print for a very, very long time. They've never sold very well at the outset, but then they get redone 5 years later or 10 years later. There's some little demand out there somewhere. And the first novel and the second book of stories and now this novel have all had, let's see, the first novel had a hardback, a mass paperback, a trade paperback 10 years later in 1987, and now once again it's going to come out this fall again. And that kind of continuing attention, which didn't make me any dull, was a big thrill, and is a long satisfaction. And in a way, that's almost on a, that kind of following is probably makes me feel as good as winning the National Book Award, which was one huge shot of a thrill. But I do want to put those two things sort of in a scales and show that they're sort of the same.
Yeah, you said that it gives you enormous satisfaction, but that's to a great degree the goal of a serious writer and artist to have this creative satisfaction. And in the writing game, if you want to call it that, there's so much rejection. People are turned down for perfectly good stories and perfectly good novels, and for a writer to find his novel or a book of stories or just a story in a magazine suddenly in print, that would seem to me gives him the impetus to want to do more.
Yeah, that's right, and to meet people once in a while who suddenly say, oh yes, I read that story of yours. You feel that your work is you know, gets known. Yeah, that's part of the deal.
And you said a moment ago that you wanted to get into politics, but mm-hmm. you're afraid that you couldn't do it because of your inability to be a public speaker. Actually, you're doing quite well. You're not the only person who studies who writes.
No. Oh, does he? I didn't know that. Oh, really? And there are lots more. Michael Arlen, I think, and in fact, in one class of mine that I taught at UVA, we had three people, all females, who wrote very, very well, and they've all begun to publish books and stories now, and it was very odd. I thought in this room of 16 people that there should be four of us who had some kind of speech impediment. Made me think that perhaps there's some odd tie-in, but I can't figure out for what it might be.
Was it difficult as a child to be a stutterer?
Well, yeah. Although it was such a part of my life that I thought, yeah, but there's some things you can do and some things you can't do, and I guess when I could get the words out, I was actually very sharp-tongued. If people were making fun of me, I could zing back. When it finally came out. And then the thing that was very odd was that when I got to school college, there was a good block, I began to act. Now, this would seem to be the worst possible thing that one could attempt to do. But when I got on stage, I never studied because I was not me. I was, you know, somebody else, and that was good, because it sort of freed me for a while at least from this sort of constraint and feeling that I only lived in this teeny little shell of my own mind. And the other thing that was good is that the kind of thinking that you have to do to prepare a part, writing a subtext and trying to imagine the details of the character's life, those details that will not necessarily appear on stage. It's exactly the kind of thinking you have to do to make a story come alive. So in that sense, I was training for fiction writing, although I didn't know it at the time.
Now, I have a fraternity brother, I had a fraternity brother who stuttered, But he was also a singer, an excellent singer. He sang with a group called The Four Winds. They had an RCA recording contract for a while back in the late 1950s. When he sang beautifully.
Oh, yes,
You act like your experience as an actor.
Yeah. Well, I also sang in choirs when I was a kid. I mean, and that was great.
You know, I asked him if it was difficult as a kid, because when I was a child, I had a chronic ear infection that damaged my hearing. And so I didn't hear very well. In class, I didn't know if the teacher was calling on me or calling on someone else, or if I answered and she was calling on someone else, everybody would laugh at me. And I think that's why I became a big reader. I became more introverted as a result of my inability to deal with it. My mother took me to a lip reading school and sort of thing. Later, they discovered that penicillin did a lot of things to deal with it. This was chronic. I mean, it just went away last year. So I had a very difficult childhood, and kids can be so cruel. And a kid, a stutterer, for example, would seem to me to be the butt of many jokes, as I was.
I have a sense that I sort of was made fun of, but I can't remember it. I mean, I've expunged a good deal of that. I do remember some of the odd things that happened to me. There was a very attractive girl who sat next to me in a class in college, and I wanted to ask her out, and her name was Diana Gilmore. Diana, if you're out there. I couldn't say her name. I don't know why. And it turned out that she lived at home, and her father was Myron T. Gilmore, who taught there, and her mother was one of the great Cambridge ladies. So I was terrified of both of them, and I thought, God, I'll have to call and I'll get either Myron T. Gilmore or his wife, and I'll have to ask for Diana Gilmore. I can say it now, all right. And my roommate, who now makes films, he made a guy named John Hancock, and the last one he made was Weeds, and before that he made Bang the Drum Slowly, which is one of the great baseball films of all time. And he said, look, John, look, just ask for Miss Gilmore. And so I practiced that. He said, now you're on stage, John. I said, is Miss Gilmore there? Is Miss Gilmore there? And so I said, all right, fine. And I dialed the number. I said, hello. And it was Mrs. Gilmore, who had a beautiful sort of jangly voice. And she said, hello. I said, hello, is Miss Gilmore there? And she said, which one? And I went, and I never went out with Diana Gilmore, alas. So things like that would come up, and as I say, it was hard in law school, and I remember those times. But what it was like when I was say 8 or 9, I've managed to bury under deep clods of earth.
You are now teaching at the University of Virginia.
Yes.
What's it like?
Well, it's neat in many ways. I mean, we have a very bright group of graduate students who come and get an MFA degree in fiction writing and poetry writing, and we have a wonderful faculty. And for some reason, Charlottesville has become a sort of neat place to live in the minds of many people, so that there must be 20 writers. And there are a lot of movie actors and actresses,
and
Meadie does indeed, and also right down the street. And
Rita Mae Brown
lives there. Mary Lee Settle, George Garrett, Mike Mushaw is there. On and on and on. I mean, there's a whole gang, and of course Peter Taylor, who is the sort of dean. And Charles Wright and Gregor, who write poems, and again, on and on, and it is a nice place to live, and actually I like to teach, and I think if someone gave me $1 million, I would probably still teach some. Just not as much, because it really does, if you teach full-time, it really drains the very sort of thinking that you'd like to save for your own work. at a certain level, it actually feeds it. That not because you get ideas from these. I was about to say kids, but they're not kids. They're off. They're anywhere from 24 to 38. Seeing how they go about their work and the kind of excitement that they have and what they do, there is a sort of contagious excitement, and I like that part. And I also like actually helping them save some time as they get on with their own work. And I've had some very good students. Among the very top students, there was a man named Brees Pancake, whose book has done very, very well. And he was a student of mine, a friend of mine, my godson. He killed himself in 1979, and the book that he left behind got published in 1983, and has done very well since. In fact, when I go and read, or you know, and go and teach at other places, there's someone who asks about him and his work, and it goes on and on and on.
What does a student who gets an MFA degree in creative writing do with it?
It's sure not an MBA, I'll tell you that. I'm not sure what we set up the MFA degree to some extent in response to the student demand. They wanted a sort of so-called terminal degree that would seem like a PhD. But there really isn't that much employment for these guys. There are, to some extent, what it does, if you say that you've got an MFA from one of the fairly good places, which would be Iowa, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, although two of those, I think, just give MAs, or the University of Virginia, and you send a story or a manuscript in and say, I've been at this place for 2 years and studied under Peter Taylor, so on and so forth. You know, I think it'll get you read. That's all. It won't get you published, but it will probably get you read. So there's that effect. But what you do substantively during the 2 years, I think, is probably very helpful. You get a considered opinion. You get some kind of praise if you deserve it. And you get and it's not just from the people who teach you; it's from the people who are students with you, and it means a great deal. And sometimes it's a little rough, but it probably saves a couple of years, and sometimes possibly more, towards the very long growth towards really writing well.
So I have a feeling that, and I could be wrong. I was a journalism major myself, although I didn't take creative writing as an undergraduate 2 semesters. But I have a feeling that the vast majority of young people who get their MFAs don't go on to become writers, but do other things. But I have also a feeling that the 2 years or so it takes to get that MFA is probably a wonderful time for them, because it enables them to get deep into the spirit and the soul and the mind of them, to learn how to use language in ways that will help them in whatever they do.
Yeah, that's entirely true. But the other thing is that if you set up an MFA program the way Iowa was set up during the 1960s, where you have vast hordes of people and you let them sort themselves out, and of the 100 people who were there, just on the fiction side when I was there, if you get 10 who turn out to keep on, because probably of that 100, 50 have the talent, but only 10 somehow manage to hold on and succeed.
Why do they don't hold on?
Oh, you have bad luck. Something else seems to appeal more, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, they may want to row a boat to the South Pole, and that, you know, and that's how they find adventure, love, and success, which is, after all, what a lot of people are striving for. And you know, this is not the only way to lead one's life. The wonderful thing about fiction writing is that it, because you imagine things in such a vivid way, it gives you the illusion of living many lives. And that's the part of it that I really love. But to get back to the structure of an MFA program, we're very careful to take very few people. We get 200 or more manuscripts, and we only admit between 8 and 12. And so our percentage is much higher than, say, the wider net that used to be cast by Iowa or other places, so that a very large number of the people who come to us and get MFAs do go on to publish stories or novels or books of poetry. Not because we're better teachers, it's just that we picked some really good people to begin with.
Well, John Casey, by the way, you're not the only lawyer either, or one with a law degree that I've interviewed in the last year or so. I just interviewed Scott Rose, and a terrific new book out, Sidney Zion, that's his first work of fiction, Lou Auchincloss. I'm sure there's some more that I've interviewed, and these have just come to mind. So. Apparently the training in law is not so tacky either, is it?
No, the problem that I had, even in my first year of law school, was that I got fascinated by the possible details of, say, a torts case, and what people would have felt like, and what they might have said afterwards. And these are not things that the process of the legal mind is to discover the structure of the event and try and see how it is exactly like other events, and then you can win if your case corresponds to the cases that have been decided your way before. So what you're doing is throwing out details of tone, place, flavor, and extraneous conflict. And what fascinated me was details of tone, flavor, place, and extraneous conflict. So that I would spend a lot of the time when I would read a torts case, which were very, and they're kind of thrilling, because when you start reading it, say, you know, on the 4th of July in 1952, Mrs. Smith was walking down the street, and of course you know that something horrible is about to happen, because, or else it wouldn't be in the torts book, right? So I actually had a kind of enjoyable time, in one sense, although there was also it was fairly hard work, and I didn't really put my back into it the way I would have. I began to suspect that something else was going to emerge in my life, but I didn't know what it was, for sure.
Well, it was Spartina.
Well, that was one thing, yeah.
It's a beautiful book, John Casey, and certainly deserving of an initial award. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.